Thank you all for coming. I am Andrew Holland, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate and Director of Studies here at the American Security Project. We've got a great event today and a great topic, and happy to have you all here. Maybe I'll start by just introducing ASP for those of you who this is your first time here. American Security Project is a nonpartisan national security think tank founded about 10 years ago with the idea of bringing some long-term nonpartisan perspective to national security policy, to look at the threats and the opportunities that we face as a country and as the world. We've worked in a whole range of issues from nonproliferation to Middle East peace to energy security to climate security, the subject of our talk today. On that subject, I should mention that we've got a new paper out today authored by myself and Philip Rossetti, who is here someplace, in the back, on climate diplomacy as a strategy for American leadership on climate diplomacy. And that's not to say that there isn't American leadership already on climate diplomacy. It is happening, and it is a notable change from the last several years, decade, even more so. It's wonderful to see American leadership on this. We lay out a strategy in the paper, and I'd encourage you to go on our website to take a read of it and look through it. We think this is something that isn't just for this administration to look at. This is something that both that the next president and presidents for the next 50 years are going to have to be thinking about. What is their strategy for climate diplomacy, and what are we going to have to be doing about this? And it's going to be a bipartisan issue. It has to be. Whether or not it's talked about in the primaries or in the campaigns, the issue of governing events, dear boy, events, are going to force it on them. So we're pleased to have the report out, and then we're pleased to have Foreign Minister Tony DeBrum of the Marshall Islands here today to talk about climate diplomacy, the efforts that he and his nation, the Marshall Islands, have raised about the threats of climate change to their country, the threats of climate change to small island states around the world, and indeed to the whole world. He himself has been one of the real strong voices advocating for leadership on climate change for a long time. I went back and I looked. In February 2013, he addressed the UN Security Council on threats posed by climate change to global security. He was the main coordinator of the Marshall Islands hosting of the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting later that year in 2013, which produced the Majuro Declaration for Climate Leadership. He's been engaged in these issues for a long time. And frankly, when we did this event, I was surprised by how many people reached out to me and said, "Oh, Tony DeBrum is wonderful. Thank you for having him, and thank you for hosting him, and I look forward to seeing him." So this is a great honor for me and for us here at ASP. Everything here is on the record today. We are filming it. I'll turn it over to Minister DeBrum here, but then we'll open it for questions after his talk. But with that, Minister DeBrum, over to you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm honored for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. The arrangements of the American Security Project. As we get to learn more about our warming world. A country's security is first and foremost a function of its location, its surroundings, and its environmental conditions. I come from a country made up of more than 1,000 tiny coral atoll islands scattered across 1 million square miles of the Pacific Ocean. While known at the United Nations as one of the world's small island nations, we are in reality a large ocean nation. We are home to a thriving culture that has spanned millennia. Our identity, our economy, and our way of life are inextricably tied to the waters that surround us. Many of you here may recognize my country from the strategic role it played for the United States during World War II. Situated right in the middle of the Pacific, our islands were the site of some of the most fierce battles fought between the United States and Japan after Pearl Harbor. Soon after World War II ended, our islands witnessed 67 nuclear tests between 1946 and 1958. The most powerful of them, the Bravo shot, was the largest nuclear test ever conducted by the United States. I was there. Just 9 years old at the time, I was fishing with my grandfather early in the morning, as it was customary, for a chat that run in schools along the beaches. When suddenly there was an enormous flash on the horizon, within seconds the entire sky had turned red. And I like to describe it to friends as if you were under a glass bowl and someone poured blood over it. The explosion was 1,000 times more powerful than the one that hit Hiroshima. But despite that horror, the pain and disease in this location, my country managed to survive. We went on to fight for justice and ultimately won our independence. Ladies and gentlemen, I never imagined years ago that I was at the UN fighting for my country's independence, that I would be back decades later fighting for a new agreement to avert a new crisis that once again threatens the survival of my country. Lying just 2 meters above sea level in the vast blue expanse of the Pacific, we are literally at the mercy of the rising waves and the wicked storms that are the symptoms of our warming earth. In 2013, we declared two separate national emergencies due to unseasonal drought in the Northern Islands and the inundation of our capital, Majuro, in the south, which forced hundreds of Marshallese to move their homes. This year has been no different. Typhoon Nanka in July left us with a $4.2 million damage bill, around 3% of my country's GDP. When I returned from last month's UN General Assembly, I was welcomed home by yet another unprecedented tropical storm that brought more than 150 millimeters of rain and unprecedented gale force winds from the west, a new phenomenon that our buildings and infrastructure are not built to endure. Even my own home was under what I call climate attack, with a former fishing boat, a 40, 50 foot 90-ton fishing boat, breaking its mooring and trying to make itself part of my living room furniture. But this is the climate reality of now. As my president says, it has become like living in a war zone. Our situation is dire but not unique. Every corner of the globe has already been touched by climate change. Hurricanes Katrina and Isaac in New Orleans, Superstorm Sandy in New York. We can't say that one storm is caused by climate change, but their strength and frequency has increased exponentially. While the rich countries of the world have the money and resources to cope with these events, we in the most vulnerable countries simply can't afford to limp from one disaster to another. The storms and king tides we face can wipe out in just a few minutes the development gains we have painstakingly made over decades. Put simply, the effects of climate change are already here, and they are devastating. Our history books tell us that the consequences when we sit idly as our enemy marches forward. Today, one of those enemies is climate change. Without strong and concerted climate action, the situation we face will be as dire and as serious as civil war, terrorism, and nuclear weapons. Retired Admiral Locklear, who served as the head of the U.S. Pacific Command, PACOM, has said that climate change would cripple the security environment, probably more likely than the other scenarios we all often talk about. Under former Defense Secretary Hagel's leadership, the Pentagon released the report confirming that climate change would be a threat multiplier across the world, a descriptor supported recently by NATO. And just last week, I was heartened to see a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal in which a bipartisan coalition of former U.S. military and diplomatic leaders called on the U.S. to lead in the fight against the greatest security challenge the world has ever faced. With experts from all corners surrounding the alarm bells, it baffles me that there is still a partisan battle in the United States on whether or not to tackle the problem head on. I will continue to challenge my good friends in Congress to sit down with me and hear my people's story. I will remind them that if my country goes, so too will U.S. military interests and bases in the Marshall Islands, which is home to the Ronald Reagan ballistic missile defense site on Kwajalein, our largest atoll, and my constituency, a point that is certainly not lost to the Pentagon, who I know have been doing their own assessment of sea level rise and other climate events there. That is why it beggars relief that a Congress that goes along with a lease for Kwajalein out to 2086 plus 20, which is 2066 plus 20, would at the same time seek to block U.S. participation in an international agreement designed to address the major threat to that asset. Moreover, we must not forget what we agreed to in our compact of free association between the United States and the Marshall Islands. The U.S. is obligated to defend the Marshall Islands and its people from attack or threats thereof as the United States and its citizens are defended. We have upheld our end of that bargain. Since our scouts participated in the Japanese campaign of World War II with the United States forces, until today, with our Marshallese sons and daughters fighting in defense of the United States where duty calls, whether it be in Iraq or in Afghanistan, we now ask the United States to uphold its end of that bargain and fight in defense of the Marshall Islands. After all, it is a matter of legal opportunity that the U.S. treat the security threats to our islands as if they were their own. Ladies and gentlemen, as world leaders descend on Paris in less than a month, they would be tasked with one of the greatest diplomatic undertakings the world has ever faced. After more than two decades of literally failed diplomacy, we are for the first time on track to secure a new global agreement with broad participation from all the major players. That we are close is in no small part testament to the leadership that Obama administration has shown on the issue, not only in forging a new climate action policy, but also in making a Paris Agreement one of the country's major diplomatic objectives, both at the White House and in the State Department. It is no longer possible for anyone to argue that the U.S. is going it alone. In preparation for Paris, more than 150 countries have brought forward intended nationally determined contributions, INDCs they're called, or proposed emission reduction targets, covering more than 90% of global emissions. Even my own country, which barely registers at 0.0001 degree percentage of global emissions, is doing more than its fair share in that effort. In July, we released our own INDC, which contained the first economy-wide emissions reduction target that any developing country has undertaken. Our message has been very clear. If we can do it, so can you. And as a result, we saw a target from Brazil that was designed after ours. The Brazilian minister's words, not mine. Despite all this, we're still well short of being able to declare victory. Based on proposed targets, the projections are that we are still on a track for a 2.5, 2.7 degrees Celsius rise in global temperature by the end of the century. This is well beyond the previously agreed 2 degrees Celsius limit, and even more so beyond the 1.5 degree limit that vulnerable countries such as mine are calling in order to avoid the worst impacts. So success in Paris will ultimately be determined by whether the agreement is designed for ambition. Designed for ambition. By this, I mean two key design features. First, the Paris Agreement needs to establish a long-term objective consistent with the science. In other words, the Paris Agreement needs a quantitative decarbonization pathway that translates into practical terms what will be required to limit warming to below 1.5 or 2 degrees centigrade. The Marshall Islands has called for a net zero emissions goal by mid-century. This would send a clear signal to governments and private actors across the world that the low carbon era has arrived. In essence, this will establish our long-term strategy in the climate battle. Secondly, the agreement must include a dynamic ambition mechanism that brings parties back to the table every 5 years to reassess and deepen their targets. We must be nimble in this battle and have the option of changing course when the conditions on the field change. By this, I mean new climate science that will emerge and the new technological developments with it. To exemplify the latter point, could we have imagined just 5 years ago that we could see an 80% drop in the price of solar energy? We simply cannot predict the advances that will be made in clean technology in the coming years. That is why we should not attempt to. By returning to the table at frequent intervals, we ensure that new targets continue to be set on the basis of absolute best technology available. Ladies and gentlemen, as we enter the final phase of the Paris negotiations, I will be doing everything I can to fight the good fight for my people and the rest of the world. As I like to say, if we save the Marshall Islands, we save the planet. This is the critical transformation that we are witnessing in how today's states think about both climate change and security. That it is all in our individual self-interest to cooperate and not to compete in a zero-sum game. Climate change is a security challenge that demands international cooperation and global solidarity of the highest order. I appreciated the new ASP report's description of effective climate diplomacy as being a force multiplier. Thank you. It most certainly is. International cooperation on climate change is not some idealistic utopian dream. It is simply a matter of the states of the world acting rationally to ensure that the most basic, most essential characteristic of sovereignty are guaranteed: national security and survival. Kamaltada. Thank you very much.
Mr. DeBrome, thank you. I think we can have a seat and we have a little bit of a dialogue and then open it for questions. Security is a function of location. I like that. Large and not a small island state, but a large ocean nation. I think that's appropriate and a good thing for us all to take away. I was surprised by your numbers saying a single typhoon, 3% of GDP. I mean, that's living in a war zone, as you say. Can you explain more how that's harming the country?
The recent changes in climate in the Marshalls, and when I talk about the Marshalls, please, I want to specifically point out that the situations that I described there are almost identical in Kiribati and Tuvalu, in Tokelau, in some of our neighbors in the Indian Ocean, as well as some islands in the Caribbean. A lot of people see the Federated States of Micronesia, for example, because of their mountains, don't realize that they have 39 atoll communities in the FSM. Mm-hmm. So they are just as much threatened as we are. We have droughts, severe droughts in the northern part of the country, and then we have floods on the southern part. For instance, we've had to distribute drinking water and food in some of the northern driest areas for the last 2 years. In the south, the island of Kili, where the Bikini people now live, is threatened to the point where we're working closely with the Interior Department to secure their relocation to a safer spot, perhaps even in the United States. In the case of Kili, for example, water is not only covering the island from the embankments, and this is a single island that sits out in the middle Pacific, but is also springing up from the dirt from underneath. So it's affecting the landing strip, but also affecting the landing area, the ocean side, where a channel was built from the edge of the reef to the beach on the leeward side. But now the leeward side has become the windward side. Huh. So if we cannot access them to deliver food because the island cannot support the population, and we cannot access them by air, they are in pretty bad shape. We just had a good meeting with the Interior Department 2 hours ago to discuss this matter. But all of these are happening now. The money for adaptation and for creating resilience is slow in coming. We have identified the need. The science has confirmed the fact that this is going to be a recurring event for some time. And, excuse me, we still cannot marry up the resource with the target need in order to make some progress in, excuse me, creating assurances and confidence that eventual demise of the islands are not going to follow. We're working on capacity building. There has never been a time in my memory, and I've been doing this for a long time, where cooperation between the United States and the Marshalls have been so close. Not just close, but in need of constant refueling. Because climate change, and the solutions, therefore, are here and must be employed now. Otherwise, catching up and applying those technologies and solutions at a later time is going to become almost cost prohibitive. If we did it quickly, if we did not wait, for example, until 2020, but started to move on cooperative efforts to deal with this problem now, including what we call climate-proofing public buildings, for example, creating shelters, creating places where people can flee in times of emergencies, where you can have secure access to water or medicines or other emergency needs. An early warning system that is capable of warning people ahead of time. All of these things must be put in place. But those are some of the issues that now must be funded by our already meager resources. If you take money away from education and health in order to fund climate change programs, then we become even less effective in providing the basic mandated constitutional services.
One more question before I open it to the audience here. Actually, talking about government revenue, a big part of Marshall Islands revenue is your ship registry.
Yes.
And you've talked fairly recently about Marshall Islands might reject oil rig registrations. There's been a big push here in the United States and the UK and other large developed nations to have major institutions divest from fossil fuels, divestment campaigns and everything like that. Do you think that this is something that you all may get pressed on, may do, and would it be oil rigs or oil tankers or anything like that, or is this something that you all have considered, would consider thinking about?
That's a very good question, and just yesterday we were also questioned on that in London. Rather than being pressed to bring up this issue, we, as the third largest ship registry in the world, actually raised the issue. We brought it to the attention of the IMO, that the IMO, International Maritime Organization, is the only such organization that polices its own. Don't worry about it, gang. Leave it to us. We'll take care of our own pollution problems. We'll take care of our own modernization problems. We'll take care of our own paint and security issues. The Marshall Islands, as a registry, has the responsibility to make sure, for example, that shipping is safe, that it does reduce emissions, but it must do so in consort with other registry services. Otherwise, it places us in a situation where if people don't want to comply with our environmental regs, they just simply move on to another registry. In order for this to work, it must be something adopted by everyone on an equal basis. Everybody has an even playing field. And if you say by a year such and such, you must have engines that do not use this much or sulfur or in your fuel, et cetera, et cetera. All of those can be harmonized in such a way that we can all reduce IMO emissions. But the way it is now, IMO is saying, UNFCCC, you do your own thing, and we'll do our own, and if we happen to meet at the end of the lane, that'd be fine. But if it doesn't, well, give us more time, and we'll steer our ships across that line at some point. That is the unacceptable part. But it is not from pressure to us that we have raised this issue. It is something that we recognize, seeing what we have on our registry list, number one. Number two, we have advocated that we actually defossilize. So if you don't have people investing in oil wells, hopefully that will speed up that process. We want to see zero emissions, total decarbonization by 2050, if this whole exercise is going to make sense.
Thank you. Maybe I'll open it up to questions here. Lisa first, and then in front of you. Jerry, yeah, wait for the microphone. It's coming. And we'll.
Thank you.
And identify yourself for
Lisa Friedman from Climate Wire. I write for an energy policy magazine here. Thanks, Minister. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the discussions on finance that are happening in the negotiations. What specifically do island nations want to see? Things were left in a pretty precarious position the last round in Bonn. And could you also ring in on you know, I mean, I think there's a debate happening. We heard a lot of developing countries say, hey, developed countries are trying to put the pressure on us to give money to the Green Climate Fund or to be able to, if you're in a position to do so. Is there an objection to that across developing countries, or are there countries like yours that would like to see a Brazil or a Saudi Arabia or a Singapore put money into the Green Climate Fund?
Thank you, Lisa. Lisa is a good friend. We see the experience of Copenhagen to dictate a little bit of how countries must look at the Green Climate Fund and how commitment to the Green Climate Fund must be secured. We were talking then about a $100 billion Green Climate Fund, which is now how much? 37, maybe. it falls far short of what was promised to be a level of funding that would allow for two things: a marriage of mitigation and adaptation in especially for the developing countries, and secondly, the assurances, if the trajectories keep talking about 3 degrees and not 2 degrees, there needs to be speeded up adaptation program to create resilience among those most vulnerable states, and to short-circuit the line. In other words, if you've got 190 countries lining up for this Green Climate Fund, guess who's going to be at the tail end? The most vulnerable. For obvious reasons, this economies of scale, population, distances, just capacity to do what must be done. It's important for the developing countries and for the most vulnerable states to have some assurance, some confidence that, for example, that we can carry back to our own people and our own constituencies that even if what happens in Paris does not guarantee a 1.5 or 2, there will be the opportunity to fix it, the so-called ambition, the agreement on, with ambition, and this regular 5-year cycle of review. But there are also those that feel that there must be a special attention paid to long or what they call slow onset issues. Climate has on, for example, coral bleaching, ocean acidification, which affect now the resources that make these countries capable of taking care of themselves. And if those are threatened now, how much more threatened would they be at a later time? As you've identified accurately, Vanuatu lost almost 80% of its working economic and social infrastructure with that one storm. The vulnerable countries and the least developed, the LDCs, are saying they should address this separately and in a way that can assure them that signing on to an agreement in Paris just does not push that problem backwards again, allowing the polluters to continue to pollute because we're buying time instead of looking at the other way around. We're going to invest in adaptation even now to make sure that mitigation is possible by all. I think also that there are those countries that may feel that discussions surrounding the issue of, for example, loss and damage immediately sends up flags and horns saying, oh, the vulnerable states are looking for deep pockets and an endless source of cash that they can pull in to do their own thing, all under the guise of climate change protection and all of this. This is not something that we agree with. We think that there are some legitimate internal concerns of some of the big developed countries on how to deal with this problem, but that should not spook people into running away from the main interest of a climate agreement that we should all agree on, and that we can work on language, we can work on location, we can work on how to do this in such a way that that everyone moves forward in a harmonized manner in achieving a climate change treaty or climate change agreement. The other issue that I think that should be taken into account is there are some solutions out there. There's already a Warsaw mechanism for dealing with this that's basically still in frame, no flesh added yet, but that can be worked on. Also, the UK, for example, has been talking a lot about the insurance scheme, a wider regional insurance scheme that would allow for some assurance that some of these things can be handled that way. But it's important that just as all these countries that are actively pursuing a robust agreement in Paris are saying there shall be no finger pointing if somebody fails to live up to its commitments under the treaty, that same kind of thought applies to there should be no finger pointing in terms of saying liability or you are the cause, because that will derail the whole exercise. And we want to assure people that's not what we're looking at. We're looking at something that can be acceptable to all different ends of the continuum, but still guarantee that there is a climate change agreement that we can all be proud of and work to improve after Paris.
Thank you. Sir, in front here, wait for the microphone.
Thank you very much. Georgis Mihalis, I'm a member for UNESCO Task Force, and I came across the project of small island states. I'm sure you know about it. Last year was an international conference. My question is, in order to mitigate the impact of climate change, so I will not address the macroeconomic, who is paying and so on. I'm skeptical about Paris. I'm French national. Mm-hmm. These are two big agreements to be able to implement them, but this is my position. And I'm Norwegian resident. So Norway has been very active. My question is, given that today it seems there are available technologies to mitigate for desalinization, small-scale desalinization, also local production at low cost, environmentally free for fertilizer. You have small farmers, for instance. What would you see in cooperation probably with UNESCO and the World Bank, as well as American government, to initiate rather quickly a serious project to serve your farmers, to build the economic capacity as well as cultural capacity, to mitigate the impact, to build resilience, and in particular for tropical small islands, generally speaking, you can become today, if you move quickly enough, in my opinion, a sort of international center of competence. So more entrepreneurial, knowledge-based approach, bottom-up, and I think your island qualifies for this. I'm talking desalinization, not big plants, very small scale, or fertilizer, very small scale, low cost, and manageable by small farmers.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
We are exploring all avenues to deal with. It's not just a specific small farmer, as you say. When we had that meeting in Samoa last year, it was called SIDS, Small Island Developing States, a UN meeting. This was discussed at length. There are areas of the vulnerable states throughout the Pacific that can gain from the kind of initiative that you discuss. And those are being looked at very carefully. UNESCO is, of course, active in our part of the world. We have just added on UNIDO, and there are other, again, thinking along the same lines. The biggest problem with assisting self-reliance amongst the islands in the vulnerable island communities is that we, for the most part, except for Papua New Guinea and perhaps maybe Fiji, Samoa to a lesser extent, most of these countries suffer from two basic lacks, and that is affordable energy and water. Almost everything that you're talking about, creating some kind of self-reliance and self-sustainability, depend on those two. And for as long as fossil fuels are the source of our energy for life, electricity for homes and schools, as well as for our transport system, which is absolutely necessary. It's a lifeline of all the islands. You can't go and come without having something on the sea being delivered or being taken away. This is going to always be an issue. So we're looking at the small methane generator here, or the management of waste in such a way that you can create fertilizer and all those. We're exploring all of those. But we're also not limiting ourselves to those small island community projects. We're also looking at larger technology. For instance, we've been campaigning for some years now on reintroducing the concept of OTEC, or ocean thermal energy conversion, which we are now engaged with the French and with the United States sources as well, to try our, for example, our country, the Marshalls, and my constituency specifically has been rated by all of the technicians looking at this technology as one of the best places in the world to establish it. We have a very high surface to 1,000 meter temperature differential, D minus they call it, that would allow for this kind of technology to develop. Of course, it's initially very expensive, so people are reluctant. It may be something that qualifies for the Green Climate Fund technical and financial assistance. But the point is that we have an opportunity here to not only decarbonize and wean ourselves from fossil fuels, but also create a new environment where the provision of a level of comfort in the life of the islands is doable, even with the onslaught of climate change challenges. But also we will be contributing to global reduction in emissions by allowing this kind of technology to develop. If you have this technology, for example, in the Marshalls, in fiscal 2014, we exported from our anchorage, from the port of Majuro, $1.8 billion worth of raw tuna, mostly to China. Because if that amount of fish was allowed to be processed within, say, Kiribati, Tuvalu, Marshalls, or FSM, you would not have need anymore for the high level of subsidy that we receive from our development partners, just to run our basic services mandated by Constitution. If we can somehow get this kind of thinking to merge into the views of those who will be in charge of the Green Climate Fund and how that works out, we can revolutionize that way of living. a lot of people report, well, for example, in the Marshalls, we have almost 99% now solarization of all communities, island home communities in the Outer Islands. That's not a minor task if you consider we have to spread this equipment over a million square miles of ocean. But the fact that they have now solar power and solar lights in the Outer Islands is a big, big, big contributor to raise the level of comfort, the level of life of the people there. Now you don't have to clean kerosene lamps to do your homework at night. The kids love that. We hope it translates to their GPAs also in time. But the important thing is we are not leaving a stone unturned in trying to find ways to cope with that and to use whatever resources that may be available to us to provide for the small. And in La Marshall, it's not so much farmers as it is fishermen, for example. We're introducing fish farming techniques and other ways of keeping up with that technology to make sure that we keep that available as another source, as an alternate source, an option for our fishermen. If you took the coastline of the greater Micronesia, the geographical Micronesia, from Palau to Kiribati, that's the third longest coastline in the world, third only to the United States and Australia. One would think Malaysia or Indonesia or the Philippines, but that's not the case. We have the third largest coastline in the world, and we produce 54% of the world's tuna in the 8 countries that make up the parties to the NAR agreement. We can either add value to that production by not just sending out raw tuna, but actually processing it or sending it out in higher marketing forms, or we can succumb to climate change and lose that shoreline. Losing that shoreline means the demise of that tuna. If we deprive the world of 54% of the world's tuna by 2030 or 2040, that's a major shock that I think will need to be considered in anybody's policy book on climate change.
Interesting. Glad to hear you talk about OTEC. That's a great, underserved area. Excellent. Other questions? Back here.
Hi, Esther Babson. I actually work for the American Hotel Association, but I'm also in graduate school at Hopkins for Global Security Studies. And obviously, we discussed about how funding is a major challenge. But do you anticipate that the Marshall Islands and similar islands will consider and start working towards purchasing land as Kiribati has done?
As a community, good question, as a community that has been the subject of massive displacement of population, even within our own jurisdiction, the thought of yet another displacement is not relished. We just spoke earlier about the people of Bikini now, having been moved from Bikini to Kili, wanting to move now from Kili to the United States, just for their own survival. And also to say now that we are not thinking about that eventual possibility would be a betrayal of my constitutional mandate to be a prudent government leader and also keep that in mind. But you will not hear me say that too much in public because we do not think that it contributes to the idea that we should control climate change rather than say now, okay, we'll solve that by declaring defeat and moving people off. The concept of purchasing land in Fiji, for example, has occurred to us, purchasing land in FSM or leasing land long-term for the production of food where our food production becomes challenged. But we have not considered that sort of as a alternative for actually moving people. Now, we should all bear in mind that under the agreement between the Marshall Islands and the United States, we have access to the United States and can, in fact, move here. But in spite of the fact that many, many people have indeed moved here, we have a large Marshallese community in Springdale, Arkansas. Most people would prefer to be close to their homeland. That's our soul. Island people, many people think, well, it's just so easy, it's easy to pick up all the people from Kwajalein and put them in Wyoming and problem solved. It's not quite that simple. Even within the Marshall Islands, moving one community from here to there is a major, major social event of huge consequences. The people of Rongelap, for example, still have not been resettled because of the testing. They now live in Kwajalein. But even though they're all relatives of Kwajalein people, living in Kwajalein is still putting them in exile because they're living in land to which they do not belong. I say that very carefully. They're living on land to which they do not belong because we have a sense of belonging to the land rather than the land belonging to us. Everybody takes care of his land for the next generation because of that reason. And so the thought of moving away from the Marshalls is not yet a matter of open and free discussion, although it's in the back of minds of most people that if this continues, you know, if in Fiji, for example, the waves start coming into your living room, you just move your house up a few feet and you're okay. But when you're sitting 2 meters above sea level, and on this side is the ocean, on this side is the lagoon, if you move away from the lagoon far enough, you'll be closer to the ocean, so you'll be back to danger again. The Prime Minister of Tuvalu, a good friend of ours, said it in New York recently. He said, I appreciate very much the help that the USAID program is providing for early warning systems throughout the islands. But in Tuvalu, if the siren goes off, where do I run? If the waves come in, I'll find a surfboard and maybe a rosary, because that'd be my best protection. And while it may sound a little bit, he's speaking reality here. If the siren goes off, there are not too many places you can run away in an atoll situation. But I appreciate that question very much. Thank you.
We have time for maybe one or two more questions here. So maybe I'll take both of these, and then you can answer in turn.
Excellent.
So first you here, sir, and then you.
Henry Hedger, researcher, now retired federal government. I thought I'd just bring up something I've seen on CCTV. The Chinese government is assisting Nigeria in the Bay of Lagos by placing seawalls around some of the islands in the large bay already. 15-foot seawalls have been erected. The island is ringed, and the water can't encroach any further than it already has due to the walls. It requires somewhat a change in lifestyle. Your islands are different, but I wondered, have you considered this? The Chinese were also considering to put a wall around the entire bay to protect the villages along it, and the city, of course, of Lagos itself. I wondered, could this possibly be done in your area? You mentioned the tuna and the coral reefs. There's other considerations, but it's a possibility, I think. What are your plans on? So have you thought of this, and what would your plans possibly be?
Hold on. Yeah, sure. The second question here.
Jim Kamasinski, Swiss Mountain Energy Consulting. I was just curious, how many of your islands have central electric generation grids or systems, and of the ones that do, how do you generate that electricity now? Is it fossil fuels, wind, solar, and also desalinization? How many islands have to have systems to do that, and what fuels do you use for that? That's all.
So your electric grid and a great seawall of China.
Let me answer the last one first.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure.
All our electricity for the main grid are all diesel powered. And we're charging in the two capital communities of the Marshalls, in Majuro and in Kwajalein, 43 cents a kilowatt hour. It's costing us closer to 60. So figure we're subsidizing every kilowatt about 20 cents worth. The desalinization that occurs in both Majuro and Kwajalein is diesel powered as well. So you're using your 60 cents per kilowatt electricity to do that. OTEC would solve that problem. Ocean Thermal Energy, if you reduced it below 25 cents or even below 20 cents, you're talking about affordable energy for all and water that can actually power our fisheries and tourism sectors. The Chinese do have a knack for building walls, don't they? Recently in the Spratlys, they've been building airstrips on coral heads. And that suggestion has been made. At the end of World War II, you remember the Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Marshalls were the front end of the American wave moving towards Japan. At the declaration of security for each one of the islands, there was a lot of diesel and a lot of heavy equipment left behind. So a lot of islands were connected by causeways to build up land. In other words, not upwards, but outward. In other words, you have two islands here surrounding a lagoon, they would connect them. In the case of Kwajalein, there's several cases like that, Tarawa in the Gilberts, Funafuti and elsewhere throughout the Pacific. The Marines and the Seabees were very good at that. Today, as climate change affects and the water rises and the tidal waves, not tidal waves, but the tides affect the areas that were filled in this process are the most vulnerable. And guess what? All of the capital of Majuro is exactly that. Several islands linked together by causeways. Aniwetak is the same. Kwajalein, of course, more than 60% of the island of Kwajalein is landfill. The ocean will always be the conqueror here. The ocean will always find the weakest point to penetrate because it's been there all this time. And therefore, if you do this, if you just raise this island up and the waves come here and they can't touch you, they'll just go around and hit the next guy on either side in an even worse condition than you have. So you have to build everybody up all at the same time. You cannot just build some islands up and leave other islands staying at 2 degrees. So it's an expensive proposition. We've been talking to people in the middle, in the UAE, in China as well. We've also been talking about platforms, giant concrete platforms made up of honeycomb formation so that they could withstand pressure and high winds and tides, and actually building public facilities on those, hospitals, schools, fish processing, so that they would go up with the tide as well. That's also being considered. In Kiribati right now, because Tarawa happens to have one of the most shallow lagoons in the world, it's a large lagoon, but it's shallow, so there's a lot of fill there that people have identified can be used. The Dutch and the Netherlands are working cooperatively with them to do that, exactly what you're saying. So, but not building seawalls that would just divert the flow of the water and not do anything about preventing the inundation of those islands. But we're looking at all options, and we're sharing these concerns with our good partners from especially from the U.S., as I said now. We have someone from Todd Stern's office in the State Department with us. Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate this. We work very closely with them on aspects of the UNFCCC's look at climate change, but we're also keeping in mind where the opportunities might be to help mitigate and help adapt to some of these problems. There is a general good feeling of working together in this. it's important that we translate it to Paris. I might add, you said you were from France. We have very very close working relationship also with your foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, and also his very able assistant, with whom we met yesterday. They are very keen to have something good come out of Paris. Norway is a very good supporter of the small island vulnerable states, has been for a long time. And we're all trying to go in together with a unified, harmonious voice that says, this must be done. We know that there will be some things left undone, but we hope that we can convince them to do this. We will also work with our good friends, the United States and Congress. I have a meeting there after this to also bring this message to them. We need everybody's cooperation, and I think that with an occasion like this, we have made progress in spreading the word. And perhaps if all of us here went and told one or two friends, maybe we'll be doing a good thing. So once again, thank you so very much for
thank
having
you.
Me.
Thank you. Foreign Minister Tony Abram, thank you. Go to our website, americansecurityproject.org. You'll be able to see the video and lots of other of our research on this topic and many others. Thank you all for coming, and we'll hope to see you soon.